Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 155, recorded June 16th, 2014. Console Wars. Triangulation is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. And by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TRIANGULATION to receive $10 off at checkout. It's time for Triangulation, the show where you do each week where we get together with some of the most interesting, most intelligent people in technology and talk with them about stuff. This is going to be a fun trip down memory lane today because joining me right now is the author of this book, Console Wars, Blake J. Harris. It is the story that begins in 1990 of Sega, Nintendo, and as he says, the battle that shaped a generation. Blake, welcome to Triangulation. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
There is something. Now, I'm of an older generation, so I got these, you know, into these games in the early 90s. I was already, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s. But there's something about the generation, your generation, the generation of Seth Rogen, who writes the foreword to this with his partner, Evan Goldberg. You guys grew up. These were formative years for you. And so this is kind of imprinted on you guys like baby ducks. I mean, Sega and you can tell how old somebody is, what generational cohort they're in, based on what video game they most love, whether it's Zelda or Mario or Sonic or GoldenEye. We were just talking about that. I take it that you are of that generation. This was a time that you will never forget.
Absolutely. I mean, back then, I think that you weren't a gamer or a non-gamer to play video games. You were just a kid, and if you wanted to have any sort of social life or enjoy the best form of entertainment that was out there, you played these video games, and you didn't just play them. You had to choose sides, and it did, as you say, really define who you were and sort of your feelings on life. You know, it was very interesting. It was, looking back, I couldn't have articulated at the time, but it was one of the first times in my life that I associated with something larger than myself, and I think a lot of people felt that way, which is why it still resonates with those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
It's really, the video game, the gaming situation today is so different than it was then. Why did you start with, let's start off with why you started with the year 1990. What was important about that time?
You know, my entry into the story was kind of surprising. But it, you know, before I really wrote Console Wars, I really just wanted to read Console Wars. I was a product of that generation.
Right.
And my brother got me a Sega Genesis 3.5 years ago for my birthday, and after...
Wait a minute, 3.5 years ago from now, from today? He got you an old Sega Genesis and brought it back?
Yeah, he got me... He actually asked me... he wanted to make up for years of terrible gifts, so he asked me, what was the best gift you ever got? And I said, our Sega Genesis. So he said, that's what I get you. And I said, well, we already got that 20 years ago. And he said, don't worry, you'll have fun. And I did have fun, and it was a lot of fun. And after the barrage of nostalgia hit me and all the memories of staying up late and fighting to the death with him, you know, I just became curious about what was going on behind the scenes, what was going on thousands of miles away that actually shaped my childhood and shaped these experiences and shaped the future of the video game industry. And I went to Barnes & Noble in Manhattan, a giant store, and I was looking for the video game history section, thinking it would be near the film history section or the music history section. But alas, no such section existed. And not only was there no section, but there wasn't even a single book in the entire two-floor store that was about video games, the business of video games, the history of video games. And that was sort of led me on my quest to write this book. And as I said, at first, I didn't even know I was writing, and I really just wanted to learn about it, but that curiosity led me to some of these larger-than-life figures that the book is centered on. And from there, I just was hooked and spent 3 years researching and writing it.
What cartridges did your brother give you for that Genesis?
What did you say?
What cartridges did your brother give you
for that job.
Oh, well, what? Yeah, got me the NHL 94 game, which is just like digital poetry. and of course, a Sonic game. He got me Sonic 2, which was always our favorite.
Sega. I have that burnt into my brain. Sega.
That's his fault.
Whose fault?
Tom Kalinske.
This is really, in many ways, Tom Kalinske's story. He's fighting Nintendo, the evil empire. In 1990, Nintendo was actually, and this is, we should even say, this is the second era of video gaming you're talking about here, because it really began in the late 70s with Atari, when it was Atari, Mattel, Coleco, fighting it out with these very primitive 8-bit games. I mean, we've shown, everybody's looked at E.T. because that's been in the news lately. And you look at it and you go, how could people possibly have thought this was entertaining? But it's really not much different than Pong. You know, you have some very simple 8-bit sounds, very simple 8-bit sprites. You couldn't really do very much. And in fact, that era crashed and burned, probably due to Atari really screwing it up by allowing a lot of crappy games onto the market, and people got burned and said never again, and that was it. And Nintendo came back maybe 10 years later and created the second era of video gaming. That's my memory. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And that's something that, you know, as a kid, I had no idea. I knew that Nintendo was the market leader. They were the Coke to Sega's Pepsi, but I didn't realize that they had 90 or 95% of this market. You know, I knew they were ahead, but I didn't realize how dominant they were. And also, you know, as much as the story, at least in the first half, dubs as a David and Goliath story with Sega led by Tom Kalinske and Sonic the Hedgehog trying to slay this beast, that 5 years earlier, Nintendo was their own David and Goliath story, trying to resurrect the video game industry after that Atari crash. And so it was really interesting and creative for a very unique dynamic where I would say there's no heroes and no villains, though each company would claim that the other was the bad guy. And it was just two different philosophies going head to head and really sending ripples to every facet you can imagine, every part of the culture, from, you know, kids on the schoolyards to Congress to boardrooms. And it really had a huge ripple effect.
I do remember I think I've interviewed David Sheff, who wrote Game Over, which was the Nintendo story. So that story has been somewhat told, but the Sega story hasn't. And I'm glad you kind of picked that particular battle, a battle which Sega surprisingly did very well in for this book, because it really is almost so much. It's almost you liken it to the Red Sox and the Yankees. It's almost the plucky little Red Sox, you know, facing off against the murderer's row. So where did Tom Kalinske come from?
So Tom Kalinske, you know, speaking with Tom was what really crystallized this project for me, because that he is what initially gave me a face. You know, before that, it was just these big, faceless, gigantic entities that made these wonderful cartoonish video games. But Tom Kalinske was the president of Sega of America from 1990 to 1996. And when I asked him naturally, hey, Tom, what did you do before you were at Sega? I quickly learned that other than my parents, he was the adult who most likely influenced the majority of my childhood. Out of college, he joined J. Walter Thompson, the advertising agency, and helped to develop the Flintstones Kids Chewable Vitamins.
Wow.
And then after that, he went to Mattel, and he joined shortly after Barbie had her first down year. Mattel didn't know if they were going to stop making Barbie or slower the pace or not really focus on Barbie anymore, but he was put in charge of that line, and he turned it into $1 billion a year industry of her own. And then he was asked to do for boys what Barbie did for girls, and he helped develop He-Man, Masters of the Universe.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so it was like everything he said, and he says it so matter-of-factly, but also in a humble way. And I'm just like, Tom, that changed so much of my life. And it was just all these things, you know, he was involved with making Popples and other types of toys and games. He went to Matchbox after Mattel. But then in 1990, he was sort of at a crossroads. He had been passed over for the top job at Mattel, and he didn't really know what he was going to do next. And, you know, I think he was a little bit down on his luck, maybe wondering if his best years had passed him by, because those were some pretty good years that he had. And then out of nowhere, while he was on this family vacation with his wife and kids in Hawaii, Hayao Nakayama, the president of Sega Enterprises, found him on the beach and said, Tom, I would like for you to run Sega and take on Nintendo. And Tom said, I think get out of the way. You're blocking the sun. And I don't know anything about video games, so I don't think that's a very good idea. And that sort of speaks to Tom's charisma and his self-deprecating, sarcastic nature. But, he had a talent, a magic touch for bringing ideas, sometimes odd ideas, to the masses in a way that really emphasized the inherent story value and the imagination. And he left his family vacation in Hawaii mid-trip, flew out to Tokyo with Nakayama, saw Sega's secret R&D lab, what they were developing, and he was really blown away. He thought, this could give me the ammo to take on Nintendo and pull off the impossible. And in hindsight, it seems like, of course, Sega would take on Nintendo and do well, or at least not even that, but another company would topple Nintendo. But if you think back, Nintendo was really dominant, and there wasn't necessarily a reason that they had to lose that market share. They had become so synonymous with video games that, in the way that Jacuzzi is a shorthand for hot tubs, Nintendo was that for video games.
Yeah.
And they made some enemies along the way, and they made a few mistakes. And then Tom and his crew of rebels, were able to capitalize on those and had some wild ideas of their own. And, you were just talking about, on the back of the book, it does compare the rivalry to the Yankees and the Red Sox. But perhaps a more apt baseball metaphor is the Oakland A's and Moneyball.
Right.
Because what always really appealed to me about the story early on, and what I thought gave it that universal value that would make it attractive to gamers and non-gamers alike, was the fact that it was this group of underdogs with one-tenth the budget of Nintendo trying to do 10 times as much and finding unique and clever creative ways to pull that off.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out how Mr. Needlemouse saved Sega and where Mr. Needlemouse came from and what he became. We're talking I have to say, it is, even if you weren't around in this era, it is a great story and really well written. And that's probably why Seth Rogen and his buddy Evan Goldberg are going to make a documentary. In fact, are making a documentary right now with our guest Blake Harris on console wars. When will that be out, do you think?
We're in post-production right now.
Oh, good.
And hopefully we'll finish by the end of the year and have it come out next year.
And I presume they also want to make a movie at some point, like a fictionalized movie. Or is that not the
case? Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely the case. There's two film projects in development. There's the documentary that I've been directing with my business partner, Jonah Tulis, and we're in post-production on, and Seth, Evan, and Scott Rudin are all producing that. And then Seth and Evan are attached to write and direct the feature film version for Sony Pictures that Scott Rudin is producing. And given that he has produced Moneyball, which I just mentioned, and The Social Network, and other movies that are based on the books that were my very inspiration for this, I feel like it's a real dream team we have, and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, with Rudin behind it. And of course, Seth and Evan have written so many great movies, in which almost in every case, as I have mentioned, Seth is smoking dope and playing video games like Superbad and This is the End. And so, it's just a natural. Yeah. Will Seth star in it?
We don't know yet.
I guess the star would be Kaminsky. He wouldn't be right to play Kaminsky, probably.
No, I think that he might make a good Al Nilsen, though.
Yes. Well, we're going to talk about Nilsen, too. Some great characters, people, bigger than life people in this whole story. We're going to talk some more in just a bit about console wars with Blake Harris, but I have to mention our great sponsor today, Prosper.com. This is an example of how Silicon Valley is taking something that, is not working so well, it's kind of mundane, and turning it around by putting a little engineering behind it. We're talking about peer-to-peer lending. It's the hot thing right now, bringing people, not banks, but people with money to lend together with people who need money to borrow. Peer-to-peer lending is really creating a marketplace, but a marketplace that works so well, and you can find out about it at Prosper.com. Imagine what you would do if you could have $35,000 in the next 72 hours. What would you do? Would you pay off high interest rate credit cards? You bet you should. Start a business, maybe do some home improvement. As you can see, if you're watching the video, the application process is very simple. Takes just a couple of minutes to fill out the form. Not even that long, really. I did it in about 30 seconds. And you'll get a quote. You'll get a rate. This, by the way, will not affect your credit score. They offer low fixed rate loans. They're unsecured, no collateral required, multi-year terms available. So it's what you want, fixed rate, low interest rate, multi-year terms, and very, very straightforward, very easy. There are no outrageous fees. Interest rates do not adjust. They do not go up, and you will never set foot in a bank. And that's, I like that. Why put on a tie when you can go online? Go to prosper.com/twit, if you would. Let them know you heard about it on Triangulation. You'll find out why more than 2 million folks now, lenders and borrowers alike, have joined Prosper. They've got over $1 billion, with a B, $1 billion in funded loans. Prosper.com/twit. And by the way, when you do that, you'll get a $50 Amazon gift card when you get that loan. Prosper.com/twit, up to $35,000 in just 3 days. And a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. Prosper.com. Not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit prosper.com/twit. PROSPER.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Triangulation. Blake J. Harris is our guest, author of Console Wars. 500 pages that you can't put down. You are page turner. We've been talking about how Nintendo was completely dominant in the early 90s, 90% of the game market. Sega, the little guy, not the Red Sox. I don't think even the Oakland A's, more like the Toledo Mud Hens. I mean, they were really kind of a distant second place. But along comes this genius, and I think it's safe to say, given his track record, that Kaminsky was brilliant in terms of marketing and creating consumer products. And what was the first thing he did? Nowadays it's accepted that you need a franchise game. In fact, and certainly Nintendo had Mario. What did he do? Did he say, let's get our franchise?
Well, I think the first thing that Tom Kalinske did when he joined Sega in October 1990 was say, oh crap, what did I get into?
Yeah. It's kind of like Marissa Meyer going to Yahoo. It's like you're being in the heavy hitter, but somebody who has no experience in this and say, okay, now what do you do? Worse than he thought?
It was definitely worse than he thought. It was, the company was probably between 40 and 50 people, and there was
tiny.
This was Sega of America. Yeah, it was Sega of America. They were in South San Francisco, and at the time, they really were just a small subsidiary of the big parent company in Japan. But Tom really turned the Sega of America division into this dynamic, gigantic force. And you were alluding to a franchise and needing a mascot. And that was one of the first things that Sega of America did to really put their best foot forward. In Japan, they held a mascot contest where employees from every level of the company were encouraged to submit their entries. And you got rabbits, alligators,
armadillos,
teddy bears, armadillos. And the top two choices, one was an egg, a very Japanese anime style looking egg. And the other top choice was a hedgehog named Mr. Needle Mouse. I remember thinking as a kid, what is a hedgehog? That's exactly what they were thinking at Sega of America. What is a hedgehog? But in the video game industry, they say the name of the game is the game. And as long as the game is good, that would have given Kalinske the asset to really go against Nintendo. And so he and his team took this Mr. Needle Mouse that became Sonic the Hedgehog, and they really softened his image. The initial incarnation had fangs. He had a busty girlfriend named Madonna. He was in a rock band. He worked with his team, particularly Al Milstein and Madeline Canepa, who's now named Madeline Schroeder, through marriage. And they worked on turning this little Mr. Needle Mouse from an edgy thug into a global icon. And it was about doing things big and small. Obviously, defanging him was a big part of it, but also giving him a backstory, making him three-dimensional. And I think that's why nowadays, there was just a news announcement last week that there's going to be a Sonic the Hedgehog feature-length movie. And I think that the reason that Sonic has stood the test of time and is such a strong IP is because of that work that Sega of America did back in the early 90s. There's been great games over the years and great franchise-type characters. Crash Bandicoot comes to mind for the PlayStation, but, there's no Crash movie coming out, and I don't think he resonates with kids and with the players the same way that Sonic does, and that's because of all the effort they put into making him real. They really talked about him as if he were a real celebrity that hung around the office.
We've got to, I think, understand that there is the difference between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. In fact, there's some tensions between the two. What was Sega of America was selling machines made in Japan, though, right? I mean, how different was it?
I mean, certainly going into this, I did not necessarily realize that there was such a distinction between Sega of America and Sega of Japan.
Yeah.
And starting my writing process, I assumed that the biggest battle in my book about the battle between Sega and Nintendo would be just that, between Sega and Nintendo. But as it turns out, the biggest battle was between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. And this cultural conflict that extended beyond issues of what is acceptable in Japan and what's the norm in America to just a gigantic divide and disparity between where both of them were headed and what kind of success they were having. So, you know, you'd started off at the top of the show by saying that, you know, people my age that grew up in the 80s and 90s, the Sega Nintendo battle really resonates with us and it really sticks with us. In Japan, that's not the case. Over here, Sega was able to climb from 5% to over 55% of the market through those early years in the 90s. In Japan, they never really had more than about 15, maybe 20% of the market. Sonic was a hit over there, but he wasn't a global nationwide phenomenon. And because, at least at first, all the products, especially all the hardware and most of the software was being made in Japan, this created a problematic situation where the subsidiary that had the exact same ammo to use when going up against Nintendo was so much more unsuccessful over there than they were over here. There was jealousy that ensued, and there was also differing business strategies, which involved abandoning what was successful in America and trying things that ended up really dooming the company in the end.
It turns out, in fact, Sega of Japan didn't like Sonic because it came from America. It was essentially a Sega of America creation.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The game itself was created by Yuji Naka, so they deserve all the credit in the world.
But the original, when they came to Japan and said, "Look, we think we like this character. We've softened him." The Japanese said, "What? That's what? This is your
exactly." But in terms of the actual character, the one that to this day, 20 years later, is still as popular as ever.
Still huge.
They disliked what America did, whether that was because it was sort of the not invented here type thing, and they just resented it because it wasn't theirs, or whether they actually thought these were bad changes, I can't say for sure, though I would suspect that it's a combination of both. But either way, they really, you know, that was just the tip of the iceberg when it came to these conflicts between America and Japan. And as America became more and more successful and Japan did not, and they, you know, it's hard to justify the reason when you have the exact same products to sell. They're, you know, so it's really just a matter of marketing and whatever extra added it factor Sega of America was throwing into the ring, things really became kind of disastrous.
You tell a great story when Kalinske called up Nakayama in Japan and said, "Okay, we've made some changes to Mr. Needle Mouse, and I want you to take a look." And Nakayama said, "Okay, I'll send him to me and I'll take a look." He said, and Kalinske says, "No, I want to stay on the line and hear your reaction." He faxed over a copy of Sonic. Nakayama chuckled, but his good mood quickly devolved into a cold neutrality. "Oh," he said, "this isn't even the same hedgehog we gave you. Where's his lady friend and those sharp teeth of his?" But Kalinske had a great response. He says, "I've been in the video game business for about 5 minutes, but I've been in the toy business for over 20 years. You know what the toy business really is? It's not about size, shape, color, price. It's about character. You want to play with characters you like. You want to become part of their world and let them become part of yours." And it really speaks to Kalinske's brains and Nilsson's design that Sonic, as you say, lives today, 20 years later, and is just as beloved as ever.
And also, you know, to Nakayama's credit, he put Tom in charge because he wanted America to grow and to become a force like they were. And he let Tom do things like that. And there's a pivotal four-point plan scene in the book where Tom talks about dropping the price, going head-to-head with Nintendo. And he was in favor of that. For a Japanese businessman, that was a little unusual, but he had a lot of American cowboy spirit in his blood. And, you know, I really admire that he was willing to let Tom have that rope and try those things. Though later on, I think that the pressure from the rest of the company and from the board really led him to changing his tune.
It seems like Japan got their way a little bit because Dr. Robotnik or Dr. Eggman really is the egg, right? And
to some extent, yeah.
And then Knuckles, is an animal. I mean, if you think a hedgehog is unknown in the U.S., and a echidna or echidna is absolutely unheard of in the U.S.
Yeah.
And so nobody knows what kind of animal Knuckles is, although I'm told they're very popular. Echidnas are very popular in Japan.
But it is, you know, the point you were making, that it is all about the character. And it's to character. Take a step back from that, it was all about the story. And that was what Tom was so good at, and it is still very good at to this day. You know, not just even the making this Sonic the mascot of the company who personified them in a way, you know, he had that whatever attitude that was really becoming embraced in the early 90s with MTV and Nickelodeon. And he had, you know, a fresh feel to it. He had a faster, zippity attitude that Nintendo didn't have. But beyond that, just the narrative, you know, he created a narrative for Sega, the company, you know, that I think creates sort of a visceral reaction when we think of Sega. We think of underdog, we think of edgy, we think of quick, we think of slick. And that was all Tom and his team during that time that really created that narrative. And even impressively, they were able to sort of transition from that underdog, we can do it, Toledo Mudheads attitude to when they became the Red Sox, the Yankees, or they became a formidable opponent for Nintendo, they were able to transition to becoming a strong company without abandoning those core values and feeling like they became a different company in the perception of those of us. Playing.
So eventually Nakayama saw the light. He said, okay, we're going to do Sonic. You don't have to put the fangs back. But the game ended up being written in Japan.
Yeah, Sonic Team in Japan made the game. And then, interestingly enough, which I didn't know, Yuji Naka, who was the creative genius programmer behind the game, he quit. He left Sega after Sonic 1 was an enormous success because he felt like he wasn't getting the credit that he was due in Japan. And Shinobu Toyota said, you know, put his arm around him and said, why don't you come over here to America where we're doing all sorts of fun things and we'll give you the credit you feel like you deserve and you can bring members of your team here. And he and some of the members of the Sonic team came to Redwood Shores, to the Bay Area, and they made Sonic 2, which I think a lot of people would agree is the best Sonic game. And it was sort of the perfect synergy between East and West and America and Japan. And, you know, looking back, it was sort of the high point before things began to go down.
Oh, don't foreshadow the going down. Let's live on top for a little bit longer.
Well, my favorite part is that people reading the book have said to me, you know, while they're in the middle of the book that, oh, this, you know, feels like Romeo and Juliet. I know how it's going to end. I know it's not going to be the happiest ending ever, but it's still fun to see how it all happens. And luckily, because, you know, the focus of the book and the way that I think I was able to help make it a page turner is by focusing on these characters, that even though Sega changes from the company we all knew and loved during that time, it's not an unhappy ending for those who were really the prime movers and made it happen. And they all sort of got their own version of a happy ending, or at least got to sail off into some sort of sunset.
What people may not remember is before Sonic came out, the intended flagship game was Joe Montana Football. They paid Joe $1.7 million, which is a lot of money in 1991. That was going to be the game that was going to put the Genesis on top. Did that ever come out?
Yeah, so that was a perfect example of why Tom, when he would come in and he would say, oh, crap, what did I get into? You know, Tom joined in October. That December, their big flagship game, Joe Montana Football, was supposed to come out, save the holiday season, really put Sega on the forefront with their 16-bit system. But there was one problem. The game was, like, nowhere close to being done. There was also another problem that Electronic Arts nearby in the Bay Area had reverse engineered the Sega Genesis and was going to make games on their own without paying Sega, and was also going to produce games for other companies that wanted to not pay Sega a licensing fee. So there was
and
a lot of problems.
They had this little thing called John Madden Football, which was done.
Yeah, they had John Madden Football, which was done.
Yeah.
And Sega desperately wanted to say, hey, why don't we just slap the name Joe Montana Football on that and forget about the silly John Madden Football. But EA intelligently said, I think that's a bad idea. I think we have a great franchise here. But they ended up working out a compromise where they used the Madden game engine to make Joe Montana Football and very intentionally make a worse game of John Madden Football for the Sega Genesis that would be called Joe Montana Football. And I spoke with some of the developers on that, and they actually would say, oh, we came up with a great idea. And then we would save it, and we would try to tell Sega, oh, we came up with this, but it's a bad idea. And they're like, oh, yeah, save that for whatever else you want to do. And so this game that was designed to actually be worse than John Madden Football And I remember playing and arguing with people saying it was better than John Madden Football. That is really just a credit to sort of the way that Sega framed the story. I think that there are pretty equitable games, but Sega at one point was able to outsell the EA title because they had such great marketing. Yeah.
Although, they didn't, in the early days, I remember this, of football games, this always bugged me. They didn't pay license fees to the NFL, so none of the teams were real. In fact, the only non-fictional character in the whole game is Joe Montana. Everybody else is made up. And that takes some of the fun out of it, I have to say.
It does, but, I think that's more in hindsight. At the time, I remember thinking with my brother, wow, we're Jerry Rice.
Right.
But just by the number.
Right.
I believe 88. I mean, we're just so
playing
excited to be number 88.
San Francisco, not for the 49ers. Yeah.
Or the 49ers? No, just some San Francisco-based football team with number 88 starring at receiver. It would have probably been nicer with those players, but that was an incremental development that happened in the early 90s when they got the licensing from the Players Association and from the league. But at the time, that was sort of a great example in the book of Sega being able to turn on a dime and turn lemons into lemonade, where Nintendo was, struggling to get their 16-bit system into the market and was a little bit slower moving, either by design or just by the sheer fact that they were the market leader and didn't think that they had to move very quickly.
Trip Hawkins at Electronic Arts did not originally like console gaming. And what he really didn't like is the fact that both Nintendo and Sega wanted him to pay them for the right to make a game for the consoles. That bugged him. He says, Steve Jobs is an obsessive maniac, and even he doesn't make us pay him to put games on his computers. Why do you? How did they solve this?
Well, that was so great about the story. I had mentioned earlier about heroes and villains, and though each company would say that the other was a bad guy and that they had done all this, unethical stuff and that they were a villain in the story, everybody had their own philosophical reason that was very understandable. So in the case of Electronic Arts, reverse engineering the system and planning to produce games without Sega's permission and without paying them licensing fees, from Sega's perspective, you could say, that's terrible. But Electronic Arts, for the most part, their pedigree for the past 8 or so years up to that point had been in the computer world, and you're not paying licensing fees to make games for computer systems. They work for all the systems. And so Sega, in this case, tried to see it from the perspective, but they were in a tough spot because Electronic Arts did have the reverse engineered system and could make games on their own. So they ended up giving them a really, really nice royalty deal. And in the end, everybody I spoke with from Electronic Arts said that they were the reason that Sega was successful. And everyone I spoke with from Sega said they were the reason Electronic Arts was successful. So I think the point is that both of them really helped one another. And it sort of speaks to another large point of Tom Kalinske's strategy, which was forming what I described as a cartel of enemies. Electronic Arts really did not like Nintendo because of those licensing fees and because they were also just very difficult to work with. They notoriously had a poor bedside manner. But they formed that alliance with Electronic Arts, and they also teamed up with Galoob, who were the makers of Game Genie, which was sort of like steroids for your video games, which would give you cheats and extra lives and take you to different levels that you wanted to go to without playing through the game. And so while Nintendo was literally suing them, Sega said, come to us, we'll promote you guys and we'll work with you guys. And as well with the video rental places, Nintendo had sued Blockbuster and some mom and pop shops for renting out Nintendo games, which they thought was a violation of copyright. And Sega said the opposite. Rental is a great opportunity for us to get our name out there, to get our games out there, and we feel like we have the better product, so we have nothing to be afraid of.
It's easy for us in hindsight to say, oh, that was a smart move, that wasn't. But you have to remember that everybody had looked to the example of Atari and how badly Atari had mismanaged what was a billion-dollar business and was, they were on top. And they crashed in a matter of years. And so Nintendo and Sega were both terrified that the same fate would happen to them. And you understand why Nintendo might have been particularly anxious to control every part of the chain, because they wanted to make sure that the quality was there. But I think it was a smart marketing move. In hindsight, a smart marketing move for Sega to say, well, let's be a little bit more open. At least it gave them somewhere to go. Although, was it Nilsson who had the framed copy of the E.T. cartridge on his wall?
Al Nilsson kept in his office a framed copy of E.T., which is sort of notorious for being the example for what caused the Atari crash, though there was a lot of factors, but it was just, you know, a glut of bad games really caused that, and E.T. being the worst of it, that it was buried in a landfill in New Mexico. And Al Milson had this game in his office as a reminder to make good games, and not only was it just the game framed, but it had various different price tags, like $50 down to $20, down to $10, down to $8, down to $6, down to $4, just showing how quick these things dropped and how worthless they became. And that was sort of the reminder to all of them. And Nintendo fought that ghost of Atari before they really fought Sega by focusing on quality control. And they were a very, very controlling company. And I think that that word control generally has a negative connotation, but for the most part, in the case of Nintendo, they just wanted to ensure that if you were going to spend $50 on a game or $150, $200 on a system, you got your money's worth. They wanted to make sure there were no glitches with the hardware and that you felt like you were getting $50 worth of fun out of this game. So, you know, they were heavy-handed and there were draconian aspects to their licensing agreement. But as a consumer, I do feel like every Nintendo product I've ever bought has been worth the money. And you also have to think that, you know, one of their other things that they were accused of and led to antitrust litigation and that was a knock on them was they would under-allocate orders. They wanted to create, you know, they wanted to sustain demand by limiting the supply that they gave to their retailers and even to the licensees. So on the one hand, you could say that's, you know, very little too controlling of them, too trying to control every sphere of this industry. But, you know, as many negative things as you want to say about it, what they were also really doing was leaving money on the table. They were saying to retailers, we are not going to take more of your money because we don't think that's what's best for the industry. So they had a sense of thinking that what they were doing was for the greater good. And that phrase, the greater good, generally doesn't jive well with consumers. But they, you know, a big turning point for me with regards to Nintendo and trying to understand where they were coming from in a lot of these decisions was to make a comparison between Apple nowadays, which also has a closed system. It's very, very controlling. But at the same time, I think most people who have bought Apple products have been generally satisfied with them. And there's a lot of similarities between the Apple philosophy and the Nintendo philosophy.
It's interesting. We're back at that open versus closed, proprietary versus open battle.
Never ends.
Yeah, it never ends, does it? This is a great book. It's so much fun to go back through the history of this and the personalities. You know, Nintendo had Shigeru Miyamoto, the guy who created Mario. Let's talk about the great creators at Sega in just a little bit. Blake Harris, the author of Console Wars, a documentary on its way soon, and a major motion picture produced and presumably written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. The team who have done such great stuff. I could just see their take on this. It's going to be a lot of fun. But first, before we go on, a word from our sponsor, LegalZoom.com. In 2005, I had my own Genesis story for Twit in 2005 when I said, I think I want to, you know, do some podcasts, maybe try to make a go at it as a business. I talked to my friend Kevin Rose, who was the only entrepreneur I knew, and I said, Kevin, what should I do? And he said, you, my friend, should get an LLC. Go to LegalZoom.com. You can get it for $99. And I said, you mean I don't have to get a lawyer? He said, no, you could do it yourself. But he said, it's very important to incorporate. I think it was less than $99 then. It's $99 now, which is an amazing fee to set up your corporation. And by the way, even though we do now have a law firm and we pay a lot of money for lawyers, we still are using that operating agreement that I generated in 2005 via questionnaire at LegalZoom. You could do a S-Corp, a C-Corp. I did, of course, trademark the name and the logo. You got to do that, too. That was Kevin's advice. LegalZoom is a great place to go to start your business, to become an innovator, an entrepreneur. This is good for you, good for the country, good for everybody, and good for your family, too, by the way. Your last will and testament, you could do that for $69 at LegalZoom. Here's something new, though, that I really like, the LegalZoom legal plan. They have pre-negotiated flat rates with attorneys in every state. You could actually choose the attorney based on the profile plus unedited customer reviews so that you can get the kind of advice. It's little things like, should I be an LLC or a C-Corp? What's the difference? Which is better? What state should I incorporate in? Things like that. Really a great idea. LegalZoom.com. It's not a law firm. I want to make that clear. I think it's better for this kind of work. It provides self-help services at your specific direction. I just like the idea that I was in control of the process. I knew what was going on, and it was very affordable. LegalZoom.com. Go there and use the offer code TRIANGULATION, and we'll thank you by – they'll know that you saw it on the show, and we'll thank you by giving you $10 off at checkout. LegalZoom.com. Don't put it off. They also have things like healthcare power of attorney. You got to have one of those. What about – what happens to your pets if you should pass away? A pet protection agreement. They'll do real estate. They'll do everything you need to do to run your business. It's really amazing. LegalZoom.com. Just browse around. I'm sure you'll find some services you can use at a much lower price than going to a white show law firm. LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code TRIANGULATION to save $10. We're talking to Blake J. Harris, his new book, Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. People tend to say, I'm a Sega person or I'm a Nintendo person, right? It is that way now with Xbox and PlayStation. You choose one camp, right?
It is. I think there was a difference between the so-called console wars of the early 90s and those of today. I think part of it was because, as I mentioned earlier, it really was the first time that I felt like I associated with something larger than myself. That had to do sort of with the confluence of growing cable industry. And that this was really very new and very fascinating and sort of the one thing besides baby sports that you'd have in common with people across the country. But nowadays the console wars are a little bit different. Not only was I a soldier in this battle and had to choose sides between Sega and Nintendo, but, you know, what I really loved about this era of the gaming was that it sort of mapped the transformation from video games being fun, fad-like, childish playthings into big business. And, as part of that process, in this era, it was it's sort of like the transition from the Wild West era of the industry to a big business era. And in that Wild West era, it wasn't just me choosing sides, but it was also companies like Electronic Arts, the third parties, the licensees, the developers, as well as the retailers. It wasn't really until Mortal Kombat in 1993 that games were really not exclusive to one system and came out on both systems, which is much more like they are nowadays. And the other thing was because although the industry was big back then, the costs of some of the crazier things they tried back then were, much easier to bear. And the barrier of entry into the market was a little bit lower. Nowadays, games can cost tens of millions of dollars. And back then, they cost about $1 million. So you can try a little bit more fun things. And you also had a little bit more variety. So the industry has changed a lot. But yes, to this day, console wars go on. I was at E3 last week, and you definitely see your Sony fans, your Microsoft fans, and also your Nintendo fans.
Really? There's still some... I'm sorry. I'm so mean. I don't know why. I've never liked Nintendo. Although, just like Major League Sports, you do have occasional movements from one team to the other. Did not Howard Phillips, who was legendary at Nintendo... In fact, you say that his Q rating in 1990, that is the personal appeal rating, they do these Q meters, was higher than Madonna, Pee Wee Herman, and the Incredible Hulk. He was a celebrity in his own right. He made the move.
He was a rock star.
He was a rock star.
Yeah. I mean, he was, as a kid, just the example to me of like, wow, if I keep playing video games, maybe I'll be good enough to be a game master and I could get paid to play video games for a living. Because that was his whole pitch, his whole shtick in a way, was the guy who plays video games for a living. And certainly there was much more analytical, there was an analytical phase to that. But he really was that popular back then. And that sort of just also speaks to how popular video games were, that he was able to surpass Pee Wee Herman and Madonna.
By the way, they were both very big in 1990. I want to point that out.
You mentioned that
he made the move.
You mentioned that he almost joined Sega. He did leave and he went to LucasArts. The book, for me, it took 3 years to research and write. And I kid you not when I say there was never a day that I was bored. I was always learning fascinating things, big and small. And one of them was that Howard Phillips, this guy who I associated so much with Nintendo, came so close to joining Sega, which in this corporate back and forth was kind of the equivalent of stealing the rival high school's mascot, because that was kind of the big motivation behind wanting to get Howard Phillips. He had a great mind for games, but I think Tom Kalinske was more interested in the fact of just shoving Nintendo's face. And that was what was so fun about the story, was that there was all these prank-like things that were being done that were not just isolated incidents, but actually affected business strategy and, you know, affected me as a consumer.
Yeah. What, why didn't he join? What stopped him?
He went out to a dinner in which he was supposed to sign the contract and formally agree, but he just, you know, in the same way that a kid would feel like a dedication and a loyalty to one side and maybe could talk a good game about joining the other, but at the last moment, he just couldn't bear to actually become a Sega person. And I think he says to some extent that he was being courted because he was who he was and not maybe because of what they believed his developmental skills.
They were using him. So
yeah, I think that's true.
So it's certainly true that Nintendo had Miyamoto. I mean, there's a superstar game designer. Did Sega have the equivalent on their side?
Yeah, they had Yuji Naka, who was the designer and programmer of the first Sonic game and all those early Sonic games that were on the Genesis. And he was as pivotal to Sega during those years as Miyamoto was to Nintendo. I think what separated him in a lot of ways was his personality. He was much more brash and controlling, whereas we think of Miyamoto as always sort of just smiling and happy and carefree. But, you know, it was interesting. The focus of the book is mostly on these business executives, particularly in America. But there were sort of these golden geese, the developers that were actually making the underlying asset that were making these games. There was Miyamoto, Nintendo, and Naka in Japan, and also those around them. So it really created an interesting dynamic.
Well, we've come to the part that I kind of been putting off, but that's it's a tragedy. It doesn't end well for Sega, the decline. What happened? Why didn't – I mean, Sega certainly in the United States, as you pointed out, not only achieved parity with Nintendo, but actually started to beat them in the U.S. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, what fascinated me so much about the concept of console wars before I even knew the details of this story or the other generations was that, you know, there is certainly the metaphor between corporate war and real war, though obviously real war is much more serious and there's, you know, much more at stake. But in this corporate war, I loved the notion that almost every 5 years or every 7 years, you start from scratch. So you could be as successful as possibly you can be, like Nintendo was in that 8-bit generation, but that almost doesn't count for very much when you have to start over and enter the next generation. And that was really where Sega stubbed their toe. They had all this momentum.
When Mortal Kombat came out at the same time on the NES and Genesis, I remember, there was just no comparison. The 16-bit Genesis just kicked butt.
Absolutely. So it was the exact same game, except the Genesis version had the blood that was in the arcade game, and Nintendo had green sweat and a little bit watered down violence. And my favorite part of that whole story is that not only did Sega outsell Nintendo 5-1, and that, you know, was really when they pulled away, but Howard Lincoln at Nintendo, their senior vice president, thought, well, you know, at least parents will appreciate what we're doing as Nintendo, the family-friendly company. But no, he got dozens of angry letters from parents saying, you're censoring the games, you can't change the content. And so Sega pulled away. They had between 55 and 60% of this video game market. And then it sort of all went horribly wrong as the divide between America and Japan really reached a boiling point. And, you know, as a writer, you're always sort of hoping for poetic coincidences and some nice symmetry to stories. And I couldn't have come up with anything better myself than the fact that in the end, Sega was defeated, you could say, by the Nintendo 64 and the Sony PlayStation. And the book chronicles how Tom Kalinske and Sega of America had the opportunity to have the hardware that resulted in those two systems. So they basically passed up the opportunity for these systems that ended up spelling their demise.
Ugh. So it's interesting because we talk so much about the designers and the games and the characters, playability, gameability, and certainly every video game player pays lip service to the fact that it isn't the technology, it's the game, it's how well the game's written. But ultimately, it sounds like it really was the technology. It was the ability to make a better game system.
Well, that is certainly true to some extent. But another big part of it is just, you know, in the same way that Sega wanted to frame their own story, it's how you frame that hardware. And, you know, maybe it's not always about bigger, stronger, faster, but the system that Sega ended up releasing, the Sega Saturn, I've had some people tell me that actually that's a better system than the Sony PlayStation
Saturn.
For this technical reason or that technical reason. And that very well may be true, and it might just be a matter of choice. But ultimately, the Sega system was much harder to develop for by the third parties. And not just that, you know, it was sort of sprung on Sega of America that they had to release the system at E3, the first E3 show in 1995. And not only did they not have the software to support the launch, they didn't have the hardware. And so after 4 or 5 years of, you know, Tom and his team changing things, like repairing the retailer relations with Sega, they now had to choose with these 400,000 units, who are we going to piss off? And it was like, it wasn't just the hardware itself with the Sega Saturn. It was everything surrounding the release that led to its downfall.
It really is a tightrope walk, isn't it? Because I don't know,
it's
some about gamers, but you piss them off, they don't forgive lightly. It's like they have a long. People yes. in the chat room are saying, "Well, you know, it was a Sega CD plus 32. That killed it, and then they released a Saturn, and I could never buy another Sega device again." And that's 20 years ago, and they still. It's like, yeah.
No, there's a lot of bags. The gamers are a hardcore audience, and they should be. They're spending a lot of money and a lot of time on these products, and you don't want to be burned. And that was one thing that Nintendo's controlling strategy really did avoid. You know, the last section of the book is called "The Tortoise and the Hare." And there's just sort of, you know, it was trying to highlight the fact that there's a little bit of truth to the fact that Nintendo sort of had a slow and steady pace. They didn't up the release of their games. They released them when they were ready, not necessarily around the holiday time. And they didn't release a lot of bad hardware peripherals, where Sega, at some point with the 32X, the Sega CD, the Activator was, you know, releasing a lot of products that maybe weren't as good. And there was a sense that, you know, that consumers were being sold the bill of goods. And, you know, that ultimately made them shy away from the Saturn, though I guess not yourself. And like, you know, 20 years later, people still feel that way about Sega. Like, it tricked me.
Yeah. And they're still bitter. Although I have to say, Nintendo looks to be following the same path now that Sega followed, going soft. I suspect they'll do this, go software only, and live on the titles, not the the platform, because I think Sony and Microsoft dominate now.
Yeah, they're definitely a distant third in this race. They had a really good showing at E3 last week. And the one thing I will say in their defense is that I have a Wii U currently. And though I think that there's fundamental marketing problems with it, you know, it comes with a tablet. I remember as a kid, all my stories begin with Wii because I would play with my brother. So if there was one tablet between the two of us, one of us was leaving the room, a bloody corpse. And, you know, also, I don't know if Nintendo's trying to appeal to, you know, casual gamers, to family players. So there are marketing issues, but I will say the games themselves are fantastic. They're as good as ever. And, you know, they'll always have great software. That's just their DNA. So whether they do give up the hardware business and go strictly to software, whether they try to weather the storm and go against Sony and Microsoft, you know, they at least have that good software that'll sustain them to some extent.
It's kind of a neat story because you and your brother, this is such a powerful, important, formative part of your youth. And I think Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, same thing. They talk about playing GoldenEye together in high school. I mean, I think for the kids who grew up in this era, video games were not just the backdrop. They were foreground. This was a very, very important part of our lives.
I mean, it really was sort of the social lubricant of the times. You wouldn't say to your friend, "Hey, you want to come over and talk about girls?" You'd say, "Hey, do you want to play video games?"
Yep.
And then you talk about girls. And you talk about sports.
Yep.
And it was also how you met new people. You know, you weren't just going to say, "Hey, new kid, I think you're cool. Let's play together." You'd say, "No, let's play video games together, and maybe we'll hit it off. Maybe we won't." So it was really what connected us. And one of the things that, you know, I mentioned briefly in the book that I thought was kind of interesting, I compared it to a secret society. Whereas in the past, you know, these meetings would be in secret and taverns and whatnot with secret handshakes. But nowadays it was just happening right in front of my parents. I remember my parents would walk by the TV and they'd have no idea what I was doing. But, you know, to them, video games just seemed like a cartoon, another thing that was happening on the TV.
Right.
But it was this thing that was going on.
Very different.
You know, connecting with one another. And yeah.
What happened to Tom Kalinske? Is he's still around? Obviously, you interviewed him. You have hundreds of hours of interviews for this book.
Yeah, so there was over 200 people from Sega, Nintendo interviewed, as well as people from the financial community back then, the magazine community, and then, you know, amongst the 20 or 30 people that are featured heavily in the book, there was, I don't know, dozens of interviews with each of them, all lasting several hours, as well as email conversations. So Tom, you know, it's really nice for me to write a book where this is a great part of his life, but this wasn't necessarily just the defining part of his life. He's going on to have a great career. At the end of the story, spoiler alert, he goes to work with Michael Milken and Larry Ellison, who basically say to him, "We want you to invest and create companies that combine education and technology which were the two things he really loved. And that company, Knowledge Universe, went on to help found some really successful companies that have also shaped this past decade, like Leapfrog and Blackboard. And so Tom sits on the board of both of those companies. And he also has his own company where he's trying to bring education and technology to China right now. So it was also just really nice for me to see that this wasn't just a guy living in his past, and that everything he was telling me and that those around him back then were telling me was true, because he's still working his butt off. I would email him. He's, "Oh, I'm in China right now." He's still traveling around. He definitely has the means to retire and take it easy. But to him, taking it easy is doing the hard thing and you know, keep building companies, keep working with people. That's what he's happiest doing and what he does best.
It really is. It's an amazing story. He's an amazing fellow, but the whole story is amazing. And the thing, the coda that makes me happy at the end is that Sega continues to make Sonic. That Sonic, in fact, is very popular on the iPad, and my little 11-year-old plays Sonic the Hedgehog just as avidly as my 19-year-old did 15 years ago. Or 10 years ago. It's still as good as ever.
And the funny thing is, if you asked your 11-year-old, "Tell me, you know, can you name some of Sonic's friends?" they would say Mario, because now Sonic and Mario appear in games together. And to me, that's blasphemy. That's like the Montagues and Capulets hanging out and having a mixer. but my little cousin, he was telling me, "Oh, Mario and Sonic, they love each other. They're best friends." And yep. I was like, "No, they hate each other."
No, I know. It's changed. Yeah, it's really interesting. You're exactly right. It's all they have no sense that there is a Sega, a Nintendo, or anything else.
Yeah.
It's all the same to them. Somebody in the chat room said this. Audio says video games were to the 80s and 90s what albums, music, record albums were to the 60s and 70s. I think that's probably true. Very important.
That's a great point.
Part of our developmental life, and a great read. Console Wars, Blake J. Harris. It's out now. Is it in soft cover yet, or is it just in hardcover?
It just came out on May 13th in hardcover.
Okay.
So this is my dream come true, my first book. And I'm so happy that it's out there, and I'm honored to tell the story. Honestly, to this day, can't believe that nobody has written it before me. But I am very thrilled that I was the one to get to do it.
Great book. It's wonderful. It's on Amazon. Also available on audible.com, so you can listen to it. I know many of you like to listen to audiobooks as well. Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. And it is a page-turner. What's great, it's about people. It's about it's really fun to read. So I thank you so much, Blake, for coming on with us and retelling that story. And we look forward to the documentary and the major motion picture coming soon. Thanks, yep. Blake.
Thank you so much.
We do Triangulation Monday mornings. It's my first show of the week, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. I'd love it if you watch live, because as you see, the chat room is very valuable. When we do these interviews, your input, your questions, I always appreciate them. But if you can't watch live on-demand audio and video, as always, with all of our shows available after the fact, whether it's from our website, twit.tv/TRI, and you get all 150 some shows are up on there, 155 shows now. But you can also get them from iTunes, the Xbox Music Store, wherever you go to get your podcast, the podcast apps. And don't forget, there are some wonderful Twit apps on every platform. We don't write them. Our third-party developers write them, and we really appreciate that. And we encourage you to pick one and buy it and use it, because it's a great way to watch and listen wherever you are. Thank you, Blake. Thank you all for joining me. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.